Welcome to Coffee First, the podcast about leaders and leadership. In each episode, we invite you to listen to a unique conversation about an individual's journey to understand what leadership is and how they've built their businesses around those learnings. We ask each guest to share those experiences and provide us with some reflections to put into practice ourselves. I'm your host, Adam Saunders, Managing Partner in the UK office and Global Board Member of AMROP, the executive search partnership shaping sustainable success through inspiring leaders. Today's guest is Mark Beeston, founder and managing partner of Illuminate Financial Management, a technology venture firm focused on financial markets. Set up in 2014, it is now investing Fund 2, having successfully deployed Fund 1 across 12 companies, one of which was recently bought by Bloomberg. Simply put, Illuminate helps financial markets players find tech solutions for the myriad of problems they face in a rapidly evolving landscape. Mark was kind enough to join us for this episode halfway through lockdown from his home in California. Mark Beeston, thank you very much for joining us on Coffee First. How are you?
I'm very good, Adam. Thank you for having me.
So I know, obviously, I can see you on the screen here. You are in sunny California, right? You've been there, what, for 2 months, 3 months now?
I've been here for 3 months. So what are we? We're June, and I've been here since the middle of March.
How's life treating you over in California at the moment?
Well, you know, I'm missing not being home. I ended up getting locked down over here, which is where, you know, I live with my wife, but you can't be in two places at once. One of my challenges is I missed my daughter's 18th birthday actually a couple of weeks ago, so that sucks. But I am in Northern California, and the sun is shining, and that's great. So I think, you know, we have to count our blessings in these difficult times.
Yeah, quite right. Well said. And of course, you are still running Illuminate from California, which means you're having early mornings. You're up at what time every day at the moment?
Yeah. So I mean, Illuminate itself is London and New York based, or was London and New York based. Today it's London, New York, Singapore, California, and a few other centres that I may have forgotten simply due to the lockdown. I get up at 5:30, and I'm actually at my desk by 5:40. I start doing calls at 6, and to try and maximise, you know, both a decent London window as well as a New York window. It does remind me of a colleague of mine who said many, many years ago, if your alarm goes off starting with a 5 or before, you're either living in the wrong place or working in the wrong place. I think we can draw our own conclusions from that.
Which is a perfect segue into our chat about leadership. It would be great to start off with a very broad question, which is, what does leadership mean to you?
So it's a really good question. I think, having spent, you know, my 28-year career in financial markets, that to me, leadership is, you know, is about, it's about trust, it's about sense of direction, it's about building relationships where you can carry people with you, or the people that are leading you can carry you along. And it absolutely is not about rank, which I think is something that a lot of people in our industry confuse.
Yeah, and that's a theme. I know we've obviously had a number of chats. We've for full disclosure, we've known each other for some time, and we've spent a lot of the time we've known each other talking about this topic, mostly in London. But rank comes up a lot for you because you draw a distinct line between leadership and rank, don't you? I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
There are many leaders in my team that work for me, and yet they've taken a lead in various elements of how we build out our business. So it could be an element of the network, it could be an element of the fundraising, it could be an element of sourcing, it could be the technology direction of the infrastructure we use to support our own firm. And people are stepping up to the plate, demonstrating that they actually want to lead us in a certain direction, and, you know, the trust is there, and we're letting them take us there, and it's a total inversion of rank. And the reason it kind of comes back that starkly for me is that, you know, as somebody that grew up in financial services and went from graduate trainee at Deutsche Bank to managing director at Deutsche Bank over a period of time, I was there for 13 years. Yeah, you know, I saw lots of people that were leading by virtue of what it said on their business card, but not leading by virtue of how they behaved or the relationships that they built or the trust that they engendered in the people around them. And we shouldn't have the same blind rank-based approach. We should value the questioning within our culture. Ultimately, decisions have to be made. Leaders have to make decisions. A direction has to be set. But you should be leading from the front.
And it's interesting that you've used that analogy, because I think for you, one of those formative experiences around leadership was your experience in the cadet force at school, wasn't it? I think, told me that was one of your first, I guess, interactions with leadership proper.
Yeah, I think we, you know, as you go through childhood, you know, there's leadership in the form of parenting, and there's leadership in the form of teaching. But then your first real kind of example of leadership in terms of leadership emerging within your peer group comes either from sport, or it comes from the scouts, or it comes from the cadet force. And so, yeah, I think that was my first exposure to it. And it certainly, you know, it made me want to go up the rank, but it made me want to go up the rank in a way that I could kind of contribute back, and we could be proud of what we became. And, you know, it's a silly example, perhaps, you know, nearly 35 years later or 30 years later. Yeah, but when somebody comes to do a cadet force inspection, you want to ensure that you put on the best show. And that was definitely a formative experience.
You have this expression that you've used, a fish rots from the head down. And you talked about that in the context of value creation and value destruction. What does that mean?
I think it really talks to the cultural role of leadership and the impact of leadership on culture, and hence the longevity of an organization. I was very fortunate that my Deutsche Bank career was during a period of significant change that started with their purchase of Morgan Grenfell, from which I think they had a 5-year lockout period. And I joined in 92. The lockout period ended in 94, and they started the integration of the old Morgan Grenfell operation into the Deutsche Bank London operation, start to really build the investment bank that Deutsche became in the mid-noughties. And it was an incredible transformation. But along the way, you know, I saw good leaders come, and I saw bad leaders come and go. And one of the things that we learned, you know, at that time, and one of the things we've learned, frankly, at Illuminate and during our periods of investing, is that once a certain culture takes hold, and cultures are, again, they're driven from the head of the organization, they become very, very hard to transform. In some cases, impossible. Sometimes for good, and sometimes for not so good.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about Illuminate then, because this has been, you know, to date, your biggest adventure. And I know culture is at the heart of the business. So perhaps you could begin by telling us, in those early days when it was just you, what vision you had for Illuminate in terms of culture and why?
It was a clean sheet of paper. Right. Nobody's responsible for the culture that we end up with apart from ourselves. And so we spent a lot of time in early on really thinking about what kind of structure we wanted to have, how flat we wanted the organization to be, how we cultivated a culture of positive challenge. So, you know, people are expected to speak up. They're expected to question anybody in the room. And that questioning is very definitely viewed as a positive challenge to try to make the thinking of the whole better. And you know, to the point that when we actually closed the first fund and we organized our first offsite, I asked one of my partners to give a presentation on culture. And he turned up with a very, very memorable presentation that I can only describe as the Illuminate menagerie of cultural animals, which make it virtually impossible for anybody to ever forget some of our kind of cultural values if you were there. And we've actually made a point of revisiting it and taking new joiners through that on an ongoing basis.
Excellent. You have talked about culture in Illuminate as not something created by you, but created by it.
I think that's right. I think it goes back to this idea that culture starts with a leader, but you know, ultimately, as organizations grow, they take a life of their own. An organization is the sum of its relationships and the sum of its values, and they start at the top, but they percolate down, and then people kind of carry them forward. So that's also part of scaling an organization, which is another leadership challenge, right? It's an interesting segue. And I think one thing that people don't do well is hand over control and leadership functions to others, particularly founders that have never had to do it before, right? The person that tells the Illuminate story the most closely to the version I want to have told is me. But if I'm the person that has to tell that story every time, we can't see 600 people in a year. And if I am the person that tells those 600 people, then we aren't going to meet any new investors or build out the rest of our network or think about what our next fund is going to be and all the other things that I could be focusing my time on. So, you know, again, it's part of that trust, the people that you have around you. I mean, my career, I think I've said this for years, has been built around hiring people who are clearly better than me at something, if not many things. And, I think that's also, you know, a really kind of key indicator of a quality manager in a business is to kind of look at the quality of the people they have underneath them, because C-grade managers, you know, or B-grade managers hire C-grade employees. I mean, we've seen this, you know, we've seen this even within our own industry partner group. You know, you look at a team and you're like, you could have done better. And, you know, then an A-class manager hires A-star people and you go in and you go, wow, these people are all rock stars. This is fantastic.
Yeah. At Illuminate, you have some really great ways of introducing non-FS people into the business. That I think you call it interesting people doing interesting things. Why did you do that? And what is its purpose?
I mean, Illuminate's only 6 years old. The why did we do that? I don't even recall. It's already lost in the history of Illuminate. But interesting people doing interesting things is about challenges that hit individuals and challenges that hit organizations, and it's about shared learning. And I think the origin story really was that, you know, when we started bringing on board the younger members of the team, they were always asking me, can you sit us down and teach us about financial markets, you know, in depth, you know, let's do a session on risk or let's do a session on derivatives. And the reality is we've seen 3,000 companies that all serve this industry, 3,000 companies, that's 3,000 organizations that walk through the door and teach my team about some esoteric area of financial markets. My team don't need me to teach them about financial markets. And frankly, at this point, I haven't got a lot to teach them. But there are lots and lots of other people that have lots of interesting things from which we can learn, right? So whether you're running a malnutrition charity, or you were running the administration practice of KPMG, or you know, you're in the military, you know, any of those things are interesting stories with lessons that we can kind of learn and develop ourselves. And of course, that's not about the team. That's about everybody in the team, myself, my partners, and the rest of the team.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. It's something actually that we have borrowed from you.
And the expression that anybody at Illuminate would use is that you've stolen it and stolen it with good grace. So one of the core lessons in Illuminate's culture is great artists steal. There's an awful lot of artwork that is derivative of what has come before it, none more so than in street art. And so, yeah, we're constantly looking to models that we can improve upon. It's a two-way street. So you're very welcome.
Steal with pride. Yeah,
exactly.
You appear to have put culture at the center of the business. And I wonder, is that because of the impact that your career prior to setting up Illuminate has had on you, or because you feel that is best for the business and the results the business will get?
So I think one thing that's very interesting is if you sit down with a blank sheet of paper and you say, what do we want our DNA to be? What do we want our, you know, our culture to be? It's kind of interesting because you end up coming up with a set of objectives that are not dissimilar to the ones that you would pay a consultant $1 million to come up with if you were a large financial institution or corporate. The difference is you own them, you believe them, and you're ultimately responsible for making sure that people abide by them. So, you know, it has to be something that you live. Of course, whilst the fish does rot from the head, and so it's very important that the leadership, you know, own it. The larger an organization get, the more opportunity there is for elements of culture to kind of get devolved away from the leadership. We've spent a lot of time on how we hire and bring new talent into the team to make sure that that fit is a core cultural fit. You know, there's only 10 of us in the team, and if you join as the 11th member, you're going to meet everybody. And you know, if my assistant thinks you're a Wally, then you're going to struggle to get in as much as if I think you're a Wally. And that doesn't mean not knowing your subject or not being brilliant. It's everything about the individual.
Yeah. I wonder how much of the investment decision is based on the leadership that you meet. You are you buying businesses or are you buying leadership teams?
So, look, I think that's a really good question. And the team and the leadership of the team is a huge component of it. In fact, I would go as far as to say that if there's one thing that I've really changed my view on since I set Illuminate up, it's the team is categorically the most important element. I think if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said product and team in equal measure. But I've often said we only invest in companies where the product already exists with some form of demonstrable product market fit. And the minute that you actually assimilate that information, you realize it's all about the team. That is absolutely key. And we've gone a stage further, you know, since those early days to really try and kind of quantify our own thinking on what this team looks like and feels like and where the gaps are. And effectively, we end up creating a full sort of spidergram of how we kind of rank these teams across probably at this point about 16 different vectors so that we know, you know, what we're buying into, what gaps need to be filled, what gaps we think we might be able to help fill, what gaps need to be managed. And of course, if there's something that we think is absolutely critical that just makes it a non-starter.
Yeah. And I've noticed when you've talked about this in the past, you've referred to the health of a team. Do you look at that when you look at investments? Are you looking for those sort of key signals to make you feel more confident about those businesses?
Yeah, we are. And of course, you have to be very careful that you don't cross a boundary for, you know, into the overly personal. So when I talk about the health of a team, I definitely mean that in the most holistic sense, right? So, you know, that starts with, you know, the completeness of the team and the dynamics between the members of the team. So if you're sat with a management team of four and only one person does all of the talking, right, is that okay or is that a problem? Are they afraid to speak up? Are they always meeting you at the Red Lion for a pint of beer instead of in an office? I mean, it's a, yeah, that's as you start to kind of transition into the genuine health side. Do these people look healthy, you know, because these are long journeys, right? You know, the average venture fund is a 10-year fund life. So the average investment could easily be a seven year investment. Maintaining the energy to run as hard as you a really focused entrepreneur has to run at an opportunity for that sort of duration does require real levels of physical health, mental tenacity, and energy and drive.
Yeah, stamina in the truest sense of the word.
Exactly.
Tell me quickly how many businesses you meet in the course of a year who are looking for investment from Illuminate.
Yeah, so we reckon that we see about 150 a quarter, so 600 a year plus or minus. We've seen getting on for 3,000 at this point. And just to really kind of hone in on our Goldilocks syndrome in terms of which ones are just right, of those 3,000, we've invested in 15.
Wow. So that's a huge amount. And presumably most of these meetings are taking place face-to-face?
Well, they were. They were before we started doing Zoom calls from California to London. But yes, an awful lot of introductory calls or video calls. And then, face-to-face, because again, these investment relationships are, again, they're 7, 8, 9, 10-year relationships. The average venture investment relationship is longer than the average American marriage, right?
I did not know that.
Well, there you go.
So I'm outperforming the US venture market quite significantly.
I've met your long-suffering wife, Adam, and she's outperforming.
Okay. All right. So of the 3,000, have you ever met anyone and seen the business, thought it was great, not been sure about the leadership, gone for it, and then gone down the road some distance and realized we've made a mistake?
I mean, look, you definitely have businesses that go somewhere through your DD process and you ultimately end up not consummating that investment for whatever reason. And there have definitely been cases where, we've looked at it at a company, been highly interested by the domain, thought that the solution was right, liked the leadership at first value, and then got to a point down the line where we're like, we're not 100% sure whether these guys are just showing us their perceived best version of the business or actively bending the truth. And that's a really, really key moment or a really key factor in leadership. I genuinely think that the most productive leadership relationships are built on total trust. And so if you're questioning your trust going into one of these things, then you absolutely shouldn't consummate a deal. And as a consequence, we have not.
When we've talked about leadership and the poorer side of leadership, you've talked about how, particularly in financial services, but not exclusively, that due to the meritocratic environment, people get promoted to a level of incompetence. So what does that mean?
It's not just financial services where people get promoted because they were good at the job that they did and get promoted into a leadership role, which they are perhaps not qualified to do. So that's that is our kind of level of incompetence. We take the person that's the best at doing the job function, and we say, let's make that person the manager of the team. And I think a really great example, which I don't think we've talked about before, is who teaches the world number one tennis player how to play tennis, right? Who teaches the world number one golfer how to play golf, right? Or we're both car guys, right? In Formula One, who's telling Lewis Hamilton how to be a better driver, right? All of these people have coaches, and in many cases, those coaches have never been the world number one. And even if they were the world number one, the game has moved on, the fitness has moved on, and they clearly were the star of their day, but they're not as good as the star of today because technology moves on, fitness, et cetera, and yet they provide this coaching element, this managerial element, this leadership element, by want of another expression, to somebody that's absolutely, undoubtedly, unassailably at the top of their game. And the best person to manage your venture capital firm might not be the person that was actually the best at choosing investments. The best person to manage a recruitment firm might not actually be the person that was best at recruiting.
Yeah. So, Mark, you started your career at Deutsche Bank, I think.
I did. And I was very, very lucky to do so.
You started Deutsche Bank as a derivatives trader, which at that time was not normal. That was at a time when Deutsche was a sleepy commercial bank and derivatives were the new.
That's exactly right. I joined Deutsche as a graduate trainee in September 92. And at the end of the graduate scheme, I rotated off of the grad scheme and onto the derivatives desk, fixed income derivative desk, where I was, I think, the sixth trader in London of what, you know, as you say, was basically the very small investment bank operation of a German bank that I'd never heard of until I applied for the job, which is why I say I was lucky. I was lucky to get it. And back then, of course, what really mattered was the quality of the bank that you were dealing with. And Deutsche had a real competitive advantage because it was a AAA rated bank.
And we all know the story. Deutsche grows and grows to become this behemoth. What's interesting to me when we look back through your history was that you made managing director at 28, and that is very young to get MD. A lot of people now will never see MD in a bank. What was that like at such a young age, being made MD in that sort of an environment?
Yeah, I was at Deutsche for 13 years, and I always used to tell people, the reason that I was at Deutsche for 13 years was because actually it was like working for three different companies. I joined this investment banking operation of a sleepy German commercial bank in 1992. In 1994, they started transforming it into a rapidly growing investment bank. They even changed the name to Deutsche Morgan Grenfell. I was there from 94 to 2000. And then after 2000, they changed the name back to Deutsche Bank. And, I was working for another 5 years at an investment bank that was at the absolute top of its game. So three very, very different, very, very different stages, and, all wrapped up in one piece of my resume. But the growth part was just an incredible place to be, good and bad, and a lot of formative lessons along the way there. And that was obviously the period during which, at the end of which I became a managing director. I don't know that would have occurred anywhere else. I think a rising tide floats all boats. I'd been there a long time. I'd bet on the new management coming into the firm. I was fortunate to be running the cross-currency swap book, which meant all of the asset side business was coming across my desk, all the liability side business was coming across my desk. I think one of the formative things for me there as well, of course, is that that's the origin of one of my sort of original industry networks. My career was based on the fact that, or my internal reputation was based on the fact that all that business was flowing through my book, and you end up building a lot of relationships, and long-term relationships are what mattered. And I think that's what kind of allowed me to get promoted at a relatively young age within that hierarchy.
And you made a very interesting move, because you were a successful trader. You then suddenly make a move onto the operational side of the business, which I think is really fascinating, probably says a lot about why you have got to the position you are today. What drove that decision away from the front office trading desk into the operational side of what arguably the largest division of Deutsche Bank's capital markets business at the time? Is that fair?
Well, the two largest, actually. I went from running the cross currency swap book. I ran the global money market derivatives business, and then I ended up moving at the end of 2000, or start of 2001, to be chief operating officer of the global rates business, and then chief operating officer of the global credit business. And firstly, obviously, there was a huge wave of change going on within Deutsche, because that was the time where Edson Mitchell unfortunately met his untimely end in a plane accident in December 2000. And she was put in charge of global markets. And there was obviously a change of leadership under him, and I was actually about to move to Tokyo to run the money markets business out there. I don't know if you know this, Adam, I got as far as actually having an apartment in Tokyo that I never actually moved into. And one day, one day Anshu sort of stops me and says, hey, I hear you're really hot to go to Tokyo. With all this change, there might be more interesting opportunities in London. Can I ask you to kind of just hold on for a couple of minutes? To which my reply was very simple. I said, I've just moved into the 20-year family house. I've just had the first and only grandchild of both sets of grandparents. I can assure you I'm not hot to go to Tokyo. Let's talk about what the London opportunity is. But I think the thing that really kind of put me into the frame there was, I was a trader who always cared about what was going on in the support of my book, right? It's one thing to do the trades and book the trades and manage the risk. When somebody comes along and says, oh, your P&L is $20,000 lower today than you thought it was going to be because of a back office error or a processing problem or, a misunderstanding in the middle office or, I was always the one that really kind of wanted to understand what was really kind of going on there. And that sort of inevitably sort of took me into starting to look at market structure and market infrastructure, which again, actually turned out to be a pivot that ends up sort of leading me to where we are today with Illuminate.
Over the course of your career, you've been exposed to good leadership and bad leadership. Give us an example, please, of a really great leadership experience that you have benefited from.
Sure. I mean, I've said a number of times, right? I think trust is absolutely implicit in good leadership, and it goes both ways, right? There's a lot of that kind of mushroom management where people think that they have power by holding secrets back from people that work for them, and there are other people that actually empower their teams and their staff by sharing and confiding and trusting in them. So I had the pleasure of working for Mark Yallop at the end of the 90s, where he was in a senior leadership position at Deutsche. I ran the money market derivative business there for him for a period. And I then went on to do other things in my career. And after Intercontinental Exchange acquired the Creditex Group in 2009, I just happened to be having lunch with Mark. I said to him, "Look, no one knows, but post the acquisition, I've handed in my notice. I'm going to go to the beach for a couple of years." And he said, "Oh, don't do that. Come here," which was ICAT, where he was Chief Operating Officer at the time. And I said, "Well, what would I do?" And he said, "I don't know. We've got a lot of post-trade businesses that we need help sorting out. But you could come here. We'll give you a very long, nebulous title so that we can work. So that gives you free rein to work out exactly what you're going to do. We'll pay you a fair number and we'll work it out together." And I went, "Okay." And that was it. I obviously had to meet a few other people along the way, but that was literally the handshake that we had. I had absolute faith and trust in Mark, and that was something that had been built a very long time before and persisted very well. The slightly more amusing side note to that is, of course, I subsequently found out that he still did reference calls on me, so it clearly didn't persist quite as long on his side. But we laugh about that now. And Mark actually has been kind to support our business at Illuminate. He's an investor in both funds and both an investor, former boss, and good friend.
Okay, we've talked a lot about your financial services career, but I think your first foray into business ownership was actually outside of the sector, right? It was with Dove House Motor Company, the car dealership that you set up 20 years ago and still own, which is quite an interesting decision because that I know is a hobby of yours, but in terms of business experience, there wasn't really a track record there, correct?
No, that's 100% right. And actually, as an aside, if you'd called it a hobby 18 years ago, I would have got very mad and not talked to you for a week. I think I've learned over time that there is a difference between managing a business and a hobby. That's perhaps one of the core. That's one of the core lessons. Look, cars are my great passion in life. I was a trader. I felt like I was overexposed to the financial services market with both my compensation and my bonus and retained stock and all being hugely correlated to financial markets. And so I thought, I love cars. I've had poor service along the way. Let's start trading a few cars and see where we go from here.
Okay. So this is particularly interesting then, because this is a business decision based almost entirely around your enthusiast status. And is it fair to say arrogance that you might be able to do a better job at dealing cars than the experience you were getting? Is that fair?
I think a near lethal combination of arrogance and naivety.
So this wasn't about leadership going into it, but what would be really interesting is to understand what have you learnt about leadership having had Dove House? Because I know you've had some bumps along the way, even though it's now a growing and successful business.
Yeah, so look, I think it's a really good question. So knowing when to do something and knowing when to not do something, I think is lesson number one. So I set Dove House up in 2000. That was around the time that I should have been moving to Tokyo with Deutsche, and I'd been trading cars personally with some success, capturing a bit of the bid offer in trading speak. And with the imminent potential departure that never came to be to go to Tokyo, I had to decide, do I turn this into a real business and actually employ somebody or do I not? Frankly, if I'd realized what a journey it was going to be at the time, I should probably have chosen not. I didn't hold myself to the same rigor that I would hold an investment decision that I make today. And with arrogance and naivety and liquidity, I hired my brother-in-law originally to start running that business, invested in a bit of infrastructure, and then started growing the team from there.
And have you taken lessons learned from the various experiences at Dove House and the management of that business and fed them back into your financial services career and your current business, or are the two of them very separate experiences?
I think they're very separate experiences, but they're linked by a set of common lessons, and it goes in both. And actually, that flow isn't one way, because again, there are lessons in management that come through the rest of my career that go into that, and vice versa, right? One bad apple spoils the barrel would be one lesson, and it's very important to realize early on, that you have a bad apple, right? I think we lost a lot of time. We lost a lot of time at Dove House because I was a remote manager. It was never the full focus of my attention. It was, as you suggested earlier, a hobby, even though I didn't feel like it was. It certainly wasn't something that I was giving the depth of management oversight that it deserved. It was only by, ultimately recognizing that change was necessary and implementing that change that we were able to end up with good leadership that has both allowed the business to achieve some good economic outcomes, but actually also taken a lot of the negativity of owning a business like that away from myself, because there's nothing worse than kind of getting dragged into a part of your portfolio that isn't going to ever yield anything interesting, right? Whereas in fact, the business has grown and is managing its way through COVID in a way that, again, it's actually a very useful to about lessons going in both directions. We have one foot here. I have one foot here in the harsh reality of small business ownership during COVID, and I have the other foot in the almost artificial world of financial services where everything's going on as normal, right? And as we sit here today kind of looking at equity markets that seem to reflect that everything is fantastic and, you know, there's no, what recession? The reality in Main Street is very, very different to the reality in Wall Street. And actually, I think, you know, as a canary in the mine, it's actually has value as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. Do you think that being that close to the business in so much that your heart is in it makes you a better leader or a worse leader? Does it give you good insight or poor foresight?
Actually, it's not. I don't think the passion there is necessarily about leadership. It's actually about how you can spoil your relationship with a passion by turning it into a business. You know, I can remember times where we've had inventory. You know, I remember a black Ferrari sat in inventory at Dove House Merch Company. We'd had it in stock for 6 months. You know, you need to turn that capital over, make a profit, make a loss, you know, but get the capital moving and buy something else and make a profit on that and buy something else and turn the capital over multiple times. So to have that amount of capital tied up in a vehicle that just was sat there was horrific. And I remember walking past it one Saturday morning when I was in there with my daughter and thinking, I just want to set fire to this car. And that was the moment that I really realized just how much it had changed my passion for the hobby, because if that car had been spent the last 6 months parked in my garage at home, I would have loved it. And so, you know, there is a very, very, very big difference between your relationship with a subject as a business owner versus your, you know, relationship with a subject as a, you know, a passionate, you know, owner, collector, you know, indulger of a hobby. As it happens, it just so happens that with Illuminate, I'm incredibly passionate about what we're doing here and fintech and the need for change in our, you know, in our industry. I don't think it's a hobby. It's a business, but it's a business based on a passion. And, and that's actually a really great intersection, right? Yeah, I can't remember who the quote's attributed to, but, you know, the person that can find a passion, find something that they're passionate about and find a way to monetize it will never do a day's work in their life, right? And I think that's exactly where I am. Some of these days are long and some of these days are arduous, but I love what I do and I get out of bed with joy.
So notwithstanding the fact that Dove House Motor Cars is probably your first business and therefore your first founder owner role, nonetheless, in financial services, you go from working for some very big businesses to setting up Illuminate all on your own. It's just you, day zero. And that makes me wonder, to a degree, how do you keep yourself growing as a leader?
I'll probably start by saying, you know, so Illuminate's effectively the fourth thing I've done. And, you know, and effectively, it's the second thing I've started in financial services. So when I left Deutsche on sabbatical in 2005, I joined a interdealer broker called Creditex and set up a wholly owned subsidiary for them. So I joined the executive committee of that firm. My role was president of this subsidiary, and we, you know, it was a startup within a firm. Didn't have to raise capital. So I'd already done the big to small. Then back to ICAP, which was obviously publicly quoted, and big again, and then back to this. Firstly, I don't think you pause to kind of think about, you know, what that means from a leadership point of view. I've been very lucky in my career to be exposed to some incredibly successful leaders. You know, I was on the board of Market, you know, which today is IHS Market, $25 billion. Listed firm, you know, still run by Lance Ugler, its founder, who, you know, Market are one of our investors. You know, and I was lucky that I was, you know, on the board of that firm when they were, you know, 100 plus people back in a barn in St. Albans, and have sort of seen firsthand the growth, you know, of a firm like that. And I can call on people like that, you know, and if I call Lance today and say, hey, Lance, you know, how did you get over this particular bump in the road? You know, what would you do if you were struggling with this? Then, you know, I know I can get friendly advice.
Okay, Mark, look, it's time to start wrapping up. It's time to start winding down the chat. So Mark, one of the questions we always ask everyone is, what is your favorite book about leadership? And I already know the answer to this. And the reason I know the answer to this is because we both share the same book. So I'm really interested to understand what it is you love about this book, or I think it's two books, right?
Well, that's the whole point. It's two books. So it's Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, and Swoosh, the unauthorized biography of Nike that I don't know if they were published around the same time, but certainly I read it almost back to back. And obviously it's interesting to get both the carefully edited insider's view of the story, because we can all fit a good story to our journey, but also to get the sort of independent outside in reporter's view of the same journey. I think it's a tale of real entrepreneurialism, and you know, entrepreneurialism is something that I'm very, very passionate about in all regards. And one thing that I just take away from it is just the fine line between massive success and total failure. Throughout the early stage of that Nike journey, they're so close to that edge the whole time. There could have been no book. There could have been a book about how they grew a business to a certain point and then slammed it into the ground. And in fact, of course, there's a book about how they built an incredible multi-billion dollar franchise. But absolutely, absolutely fascinating to get the two different vantage points on the exact same journey.
Okay, Mark, if you could go back in time and visit your younger self, what gem from your 30 year plus experience in business would you give yourself, and why?
Good question. I would tell myself to find something I was passionate about, become world class at it, and then work out how to monetize it, and frankly, to make sure you did, because I think those opportunities that you get in life that are few and far between to actually become world class at something deserve to be monetized, and you should really, really go for it.
Excellent, excellent bit of advice. Okay, Mark, we're going to ask you a few more questions, and then we're going to let you get on with the rest of your day.
Okay.
Right, Mark, are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Rapid fire away.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Which coffee, out of interest?
I'm a Nespresso guy. I know it's not the most environmentally friendly, but time is money.
Okay. Book or Audible?
A book.
TV series or movie?
Movie, but only on a proper size screen with proper sound.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's absolutely fair. I can get with that. Cats or dogs?
Dogs. Allergic to cats.
Telephone call or email?
Telephone call. But that's a whole separate hour in itself.
Instagram or Twitter?
Instagram.
Apple or Android?
Apple.
Morning guy or evening guy?
The funny thing is, my stepson asked me that exact question yesterday. And I'm definitely an evening person, but when it comes to working out, I like to work out first thing in the morning. So I'm actually just not very good at sleeping.
Okay. Do you work out every day?
I should work out every day.
You should be working out now, shouldn't you?
I should be working out now.
It's stopping you doing that. Okay. What's your biggest pet peeve and why?
Bad manners is my biggest pet peeve, because there's just no excuse for it. There's just no excuse for it. Politeness costs nothing.
Okay. When lockdown is over and flights are opened up, where's the first place you're going to fly to and why?
Possibly before flights are opened up, I'm going to go and see my daughters. I got locked down in California. My kids, although, they're adults, 21 and just 18, I missed my daughter's 18th birthday, and I need to give them a hug. I need to give my parents a hug. I need to give my nephew, my sister a hug. Family Fridays on Zoom is great, but there's a lot of hugs that need to be given out.
I hear you. I think that's a really, really great place to finish. So, Mark, I'm going to say thank you very, very much. It's been a really interesting chat. And I know we've had this chat hundreds of times over.
throughout the last 20 years. And I'm sure everyone's going to get as much from it as I have. So thanks again. Really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Coffee First. Please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, follow our Twitter account, CoffeeFirst13, and follow the Amrop UK LinkedIn page for all company updates. We look forward to inviting you back for the next episode of Coffee First.